Hosea chapter 2, verse 14. We'll probably make reference back to the first 13 verses. And remember, this is that startling transition. In fact, I was reading somebody this week, he said, that therefore is just really confusing. Because when you get to verse 14 and it says therefore, you are expecting, therefore, God will have nothing to do with Israel. Therefore, God will put Israel away like a bad wife. Therefore, God is done with Israel. That's what everyone expects after the therefore. But then again, who knows the mind of God? And who can fathom his mercy and his compassion? Therefore, after all the things that they've done wrong, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at a time when she came out of the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field and the birds of the heavens and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, the war from the land. And I will make you lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Let's stop there for a second because I hope you caught it. This is God's counter to whore, whore, whore. That startling use of that word in chapter 1 that confronts them of their sin, God turns it and brings a new word. I will betroth you. I will betroth you. I will betroth you. Three times in one verse, just as that word whore, three times in one verse, startled us with the significance of Israel's sin, three times the word betroth in one verse startles us with the forgiveness, loving kindness, compassion, and mercy of God. I will betroth you. And in that day I will answer, declares the Lord, I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth, and the earth shall answer the grain and the wine and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel. And I will sow for her myself in the land, and I will have mercy on no mercy, and I will say to not my people, you are my people, and he shall say, you are my God. And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins, so I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lethic of barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. And afterward the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. I want to begin with chapter 3. Partly because sometimes illustrations are easier for us to understand than prophecies, especially poetry. When our prophets get into poetry, lots of times they make so many references that the audience would be aware of that we are completely oblivious to, that it's hard to understand what he's saying. For example, the Valley of Achor. I suspect that there's not too many people in this room that knows what he means when he says, hey, I'm going to turn the Valley of Achor into the door of hope. But I guarantee you every Israelite knew what he meant when he said the Valley of Achor. They couldn't forget it because God wouldn't let them forget it, because in the Valley of Achor stood a massive pile of stones. And that pile of stones was on top of a bunch of dead bodies. Achan and his family. And it was right as you come into the promised land, because there Achan sinned against God and took that which God said to dedicate to him, that which he said belonged to him, Achan took it for himself. And consequently, God brought judgment on the whole nation. And men died in a battle against Ai until finally Joshua came to the realization that there was sin in the camp, right? There's sin in the camp. And we need to find out where that sin is. And it lied in the family of Achan. And Achan and his family, who had hid these things in their tent, they're taken out and they're stoned to death there. And then stones are piled on top of it. You don't really want to get graphic with this, but you want to see the severity. They were stoned. Then they burned their bodies. Then they were stoned again. And then they piled stones up on top of them till there was a big heap of stones, which remained in the land as a reminder to Israel of why it is so wrong to take for yourself what belongs to God. Well, of course, Hosea in chapter 1, that's really what he's getting at with Israel. God's judgment is coming upon you because you have taken something that belongs to God. But worse than taking it for yourself, you have taken what belongs to God and you have given it to your lovers. You've given it to the Canaanite gods. You've given it to Baal and to Ashtoreth. You've given it to Moab's gods, Molech. You've given it to other gods, that which belongs only to Yahweh. You've given yourself. Like a wife gives herself to a lover when it belongs to her husband. That's what you have done. Much like what Achan did there. But here, the point is, that place of judgment, that place that has stood for hundreds of years in Israel as a reminder of God's jealousy, will now become a place of restoration, will now become a place of hope, a door and gateway of hope. So it's challenging sometimes if we don't know these stories, but they, I mean, we do know them, but you know, when you just hear it once, that's not the same as an Israelite who walks by that pile of rocks all through his life. And what's that there for? Oh yeah, that was not a good time in our history. That was just not a good thing that happened. They know these references. They get what Hosea is saying. But I want us to turn to chapter 3 because we get illustrations. Modern biblical readers, we get the illustration. And so here, let's begin with the illustration and work it back into chapter 2 and see what God is saying about Israel. And the Lord said to me, go again. Now this could be, and again the Lord said to me. It really doesn't matter because in the end, I think it tells us that this woman is in fact Gomer. This is not some new woman in the story. This is in fact Gomer, and one of the ways we know it's Gomer is she is an adulteress. To be an adulteress, you have to be cheating on a husband. I am pretty confident that God did not say to Hosea, go and take a woman who is committing adultery against her husband and take her to be your wife, because what would that be? He'd be committing adultery with her because that woman belongs to somebody else. There's only one possible explanation of who this woman is once Hosea mentions the fact that she's an adulteress. It's his own wife. The adultery is against him. That's why he can be the only one to go and take her to be his wife, which raises a question. Why is she not named? Didn't it strike you as strange? Those of you, ladies especially, that have studied this in the past, because I know you're going to come to this chapter, because this has got some great things in terms of God bringing reconciliation. Didn't it strike you as odd that her name was not given? And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman. Love a woman. God told me to go and love a woman. In other words, it's God who wouldn't mention her name. God, it shouldn't it have said, go and love your wife, Gomer. Go and love your wife, Gomer, and bring her back. No, go and love a woman who is loved by another and is an adulteress. See, I think we see some things about how God is perceiving Israel here. And he wants Hosea to understand the same is true of his wife, Gomer. First of all, it's not an accident that God does not name her. Because, like Israel, Israel has lost her right to that name. She has lost her right to the name of Israel. God isn't going to call her by her name. She's just a woman now. Now, I think Hosea does this in several other passages where he comes right out and says, guys, because of Israel's wickedness, because of their sin, they're going to go into exile and they will become like who? The Goyim. They will become like all the Goyim. What are the Goyim? Gentile nations. The Goyim is Gentile nations. So Israel, God's chosen people, his beloved, his my people, Ami, my people, they will become Lo-Ami, not my people. Lo-Ruhama, not my beloved, not my chosen. They will become Goyim. They'll become like Gentiles. Well, here it is in chapter 3. She's just a woman. She's just another woman. That's how God refers to her, refers to Gomer, because that's how he sees Israel. She has made herself just another woman amongst all the women of the world. She's just amongst those Goyim until God has to do a second time, bring about a new covenant to make her his bride again, to bring her back into relationship with her. So he calls her woman who is loved by another. Now, this does not actually mean that there's somebody out there that cares deeply for her. This actually means there's somebody out there that's sleeping with her. And in fact, as we go through the passage a little farther, I think we see that he doesn't really care that much for her. But there's somebody out there that is sleeping with her, that she has given herself to. In other words, it is not the actions of Gomer. It is not some regret or remorse, godly sorrow that has all of a sudden sprung up into the heart of Gomer that then motivates Hosea saying, I'll give you a second chance. You know, we see this all the time today about we need to give people second chances, right? You see it in sports all the time. You see it in politics all the time. They do something horrific. Well, we need to give them a second chance. God gives Israel a second chance. But you know what the difference is when God gives Israel a second chance and all the second chances we see in this world? I've yet to see someone say, we need to give somebody a second chance who has not repented of the first one. Right? They have to repent of the first one before we're going to give them a second chance. You know, I'm not going to give Tiger Woods a second chance until he acknowledges before everyone what I did was wrong. And that's true of every second chance we see. When we hear it all the time, we need to give people second chances. It always presumes a recognition of wrongness and a repentance of it. Not only do you not have Gomer or Israel recognizing their wrongness, not only do you not have them repenting of it, what do you have? She's still living with the guy. She's in the midst of her wrongness. She's in the midst of her sin. And God says to Hosea, hey, Hosea, I want you to go to your wife who is in the midst of her absolute sin of adultery, breaking trust with you, hurting you deeply. I want you to go to her while she's in the midst of hurting you. I want you to give her a second chance. I want you to bring her back and take her into your home, because that's what I'm going to do with Israel. Because do we really fathom the love of God? Can we even grasp this? I've said this before. When people suggest to me that any human being out there is more gracious and merciful than God, because they would do something different than God would do when he brings his judgment, I chuckle. Really? I'd like to see the human being that would do what God does here. I've yet to see it. And think of this as a book and all that God is saying about what he is willing to do. It's incredible, and I know no human being that does this. It just echoes in the words of Paul, while we were still his enemy. While we were still sleeping in our lover's bed, committing adultery against him, he came and bought us and took us home. Nobody does that. But God does, because his love and his mercy is almost beyond our comprehension. And so she is an adulteress, loved by another, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisin. Let me just say something about being a prophet here for a moment. Notice that God commands Hosea to do what? Go get your wife and bring her back home. Not quite, right? Love her. That's what God commanded him to do. Hey guys, if you're a prophet and God comes to you and says, this is going to be tough, but you know that adulterous wife of yours, Gomer? You need to go and buy her back and bring her home. Really, Lord? That's tough. But that's nowhere near as tough if God comes to you, your God, the God you worship, and says, Hosea, you know that Gomer girl that you married, that I had you marry? I want you to go and I want you to love her. Love her as I have loved the children of Israel. Wow. Let's be honest. Hosea can't do this unless God somehow, through the power of his spirit, enables him to do it. I want you to go and love Gomer, because that's how I feel about Israel. I love the children of Israel. And as we are thinking about that word love, and we've talked about it throughout in Hosea, the different meanings of these words of God's love, his loving kindness, his compassion and mercy, his tenderness, his tender care. This is when he says to Hosea, I want you to go and love her, unfortunately he uses that, I want you to go and show her tenderness and kindness and compassion for her. You know how hard it would be for Hosea to have compassion for Gomer in the midst of this? But that's what God calls him to do. And it's interesting to me that as he is talking about his own love, he sort of contrasts it with what Israel loves, right? God loves his children who have defied him, who've rebelled against him, who are walking in disobedience, though they turn to other gods and they love cakes of raisins. See, even God is, actually God's the first one to make this play on words. You hear people talk about this all the time. We use love way too loosely, right? I love my wife. I love my daughter, Amelia. I love donuts. How can we use the same word? How can we use the same word? This is exactly what God's doing here. And basically has donuts. Cakes of raisin. Raisins, of course, you know, they harvested grapes, and when they dried those grapes out, there's a lot of sugar within those raisins. These were sweet cakes. They were eaten, lots of times they would eat these because it gave them bursts of energy. They were basically, you know, why we eat a Snickers bar. That's what it is. They love Snickers bars. I loved them, and this is what my love looks like. And what do I get from them? They love cakes of raisins. They love pastries. I don't think they really understand what love is. Instead of responding to my love for them with an equal love for me, they use that word with almost anything in their life. They love all kinds of things. At least they claim to, but they don't love me. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lethek of barley. The grain comes to about 6 bushels, maybe 6.5 bushels, something like 300 liters. If you can imagine a 2-liter bottle, 150 2-liter bottles filled with grain, and 15 shekels of silver. The question that everybody asks when they read this passage is, who's he buying her from? Who's he paying? Because as you can see here, guys, this is an important part of the parallel with God in Israel and God in us, right? I want you to go and get her. What's it going to take? Well, you're going to have to buy her back. That's the word redeem. You're going to have to purchase your own wife back. This is the ultimate insult. It's like, you know, a few months ago, my bicycle was stolen. If I found my bicycle in some pawn shop and I was forced to buy my own bike back, let me tell you, I'm going to be a little bit resentful. I'm going to be resentful that I have to buy my bike back. It's mine. Why should I have to buy it back? They should give it to me. They should have never bought it from somebody else who stole it from me. That's my bike. I shouldn't have to buy it back. But that's what you have to do sometimes, especially if you can't prove it's your bike. You have to redeem it. You have to purchase it back. Isn't this how Hosea is going to be thinking? Hosea comes along, this is my wife you're sleeping with. Because this is where insult becomes injury, right? What if the passage is saying that Hosea has to buy her back from that man who is now her lover? Now that's adding insult to injury, right? She's my wife. She belongs to me. Now I have to buy her from somebody she doesn't belong to. That's what God did for us, right? God redeemed us from sin. We are slaves to sin. God did not create us to be slaves to sin. We are his children. We are the children of God, and we went out, rebelled against our Father, and sold ourselves into slavery to sin. And our Father came and found us and bought us out of slavery and bought us back and made us his children again. That's what he did. And that's what Hosea is asked to do with Gomer. And why? Because God is trying to get this message across. Israel, I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to buy you back. You belong to me, but you have sold yourself to something else. And I'm going to purchase you back. I don't know what we can take from 15 shekels of silver is quite a bit. Typically, 30 shekels of silver is the price of a slave. Sometimes it's 20 shekels. In fact, most of the time, I think it's more like 20 shekels of silver was the price of the slave. Someone suggests, and probably close, it's probably accurate even if it doesn't mean it here, that because Gomer was a woman, she would have been cheaper as a slave. That 15 shekels may have been the price of a female slave in Hosea's day. In other words, Gomer has enslaved herself, literally enslaved herself, to her lover. And Hosea has to buy her out of that relationship. She has become his slave. She's not his wife. She's never called the man's wife. She has sold herself into slavery to him. And here comes her husband, and he purchases her out of that slavery so that she can return with him. And then we read, and I said to her, because she's now free, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. I think that this section is actually referring to two historical events in Israel's life. Now, all it is in the illustration is, Hosea says to Gomer, this is what you need to do. And that's the end of the illustration. The truth is, it may be the end of the illustration because in real life with Hosea and Gomer, because there's no guarantee that Gomer did what Hosea said. I mean, we would like to think that, right? We would like to think that any man who showed this kind of love for his wife, surely she would finally get it and respond to that love and say, I will do what you've asked of me. But you know what? The text doesn't tell us that. It doesn't tell us she does that. And there's no guarantee that she did it. which ruins all of our love stories, you know, that we base on Hosea, because we have to presume that happens. Think about Israel. They don't, at least initially, they don't respond to the love of God. In fact, what is referred to here is, I want you to live with me for a while, but we're not going to have the same relationship that we had before. Not yet. We're going to have it down the road, but we're not going to have it yet. Because it parallels Israel being taken into exile. When God took them into exile, he took away their kings. He took away their temple, right? He took away the sacrificial system. Their sacrifices are gone. But you know what else he took away? He took away their idols. He took away their idolatry. He took away all those Canaanite things that they were worshiping, because, you know, now they're in Babylon or they're scattered all over the world where those gods have no power. This is, once again, we don't think like this. But there's no point in worshiping Baal if you live in Assyria. Why? Because Baal is the god of the land of Canaan. And his power extends only to the borders of Canaan. So there's no point in hauling Baal along with you to Assyria and worshiping him in Assyria, because that's the way ancient peoples understood their gods, except for Israel. Israel comes along and says, no, our God is the God of everywhere. Even the Babylonians understood their God that way. The only difference was that they believed that as they went to places, their God went with them, and their God could conquer other gods of those places. But even their God, who was Marduk, that God was a God of that particular place, but not Israel's God. He was the creator of the universe. So as God takes Israel into exile, he strips them naked of all these things. They lose even good things and bad things. They lose their king. They lose their leaders. They lose their princes. They lose their priests. They lose their sacrificial systems. They lose the ephod, which the priests would wear. They lose some of these ceremonial type of things. They lose their day of rest. They lose all kinds of things that God had granted them. And then they also lost things that they had given themselves to. And that's what happened when Israel was taken into exile. And Hosea's point, or God's point to Hosea, is you say this to her because there's going to be a period of time. They will be mine. They will be in my house. But we won't be married. There's a time where there's some purification that has to take place. And then at the end of that time, what will happen? And afterward, verse 5, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord. They will seek me. They will respond to my overtures of love for them. They will seek the Lord Yahweh, their God. And this is significant, and David, their king. Why is that significant? Well, because for hundreds of years, Israel has not followed David and his line. They have broke away from David and his line. And they have created their own lines of kings. So when they come back, when Israel, the 10 northern tribes, come back, they can only come back when they acknowledge the line of David. Now, obviously, I don't think it's referring to actual David. He's dead. But it is the son of David that they will seek and who will be placed over them. And that's why it ends with, this happens in what? The latter days. This all happens in the latter days. All right, that's the illustration. He spelled out this happening in poetry in the verses before it. And we have a few minutes, so I'd like to take a look at a couple of those verses and maybe illustrate them and then talk about some application for us. Turn back to verse 14. Therefore, this is God actually now working with Israel. So in that part of the illustration where he says to Hosea, I want you to go and get her and bring her here. This is that part. This is when God actually does it. He goes and he gets Israel from her lovers, from the idols, and he brings her to a place. And where does he bring her? Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. Well, let's just talk about the imagery first, and then I'll suggest something that I think he may be referring to. Let's talk about the fact that God allures Israel out into the wilderness. First of all, that is a Hebrew word that has sort of a romantic, even sexual overtones to it. So he's talking about, he's going to, even the way we use it, allure. That's why lure is not enough. Lure is what you do to a fish. allure is what you do to a woman. there's a little bit of a difference in bringing that person. You are sweet talking her, we might say, 50 years ago. You know, you're going to sweet talk. This is what God's going to do. He's going to sweet talk her, speak tenderly. And he brings her out into the wilderness. Why? Why does he bring her to the wilderness? Well, you know, the wilderness has all kinds of imagery in the Bible, and there's a lot of reasons one could guess might be behind this. For example, the wilderness is a place where God meets with his people. That's often where God has an encounter with his people. It goes before the people of Israel coming out of Egypt and meeting with God at Mount Sinai. That was the whole point. Let them go out into the wilderness. Why? So that they can have an encounter with their God, Yahweh. Okay, that happened, and it's referred to in this passage, when they came out of Egypt. But that's not even the first time that happened. You see this in several places. You see it in the life of Jacob, that God takes him out into the wilderness, and he has an encounter with God, and never forgets it. He never forgets that encounter, because he walked away with some wounds on his hip. But you see this with Elijah. God takes Elijah out into the wilderness and has an encounter with God. Moses, before he is ready to lead the people, God drags his sorry rear end out of Egypt, out into the wilderness, because he cannot lead the people of God until he's had an encounter with him. And he has an encounter at the burning bush. So the wilderness is often a place where God encounters his people. So it would be natural for him to lure her out into that place where he often encounters them, encounters those people. But you know what? There's something else that often happens in the wilderness. We see it with the people of Israel, and since he's going to mention that story, it may have something to do with this as well. The wilderness is a place where people learn to rely entirely upon God and not themselves. Think about the Israelites when they came out of Egypt. How are they going to eat? How are they going to drink? Who's going to take care of their most basic needs? See, the wilderness is a great place for Israel to meet their God and understand the relationship they have with their God. Because in the wilderness, you're not growing crops. You're not going to be able to sustain yourself with your hard work. Unless you consider hard work getting up every morning and collecting the manna that's spread out on the ground. Unless that's what you consider hard work. See, in the wilderness, Israel learned God is the provider of all things, the source of everything that we need. And sometimes God has to take us into very difficult circumstances before we are able and willing to see that. He's the one that provides. You see, Hosea's day is not too different than our own, at least recently, until the last few months maybe. In the reign of Jeroboam II, it was one of the most prosperous times in Israel's history. They were rolling in the dough. They weren't listening to prophets because why? Everything's great. Obviously, God loves us. When Hosea was called to go and speak to the people of Israel, it was during a time where who wants to listen to a prophet or a preacher? Everything is great. Everybody is, all their farmland is lush. The water is coming in its seasons. They were taking credit for everything, and if they weren't taking personal credit for it, they were giving credit to the fact that they had started worshiping the Canaanite gods. And boy, they have been doing just a bang-up job in taking care of our needs. That's what we learned in the previous passage. And when that happens, when the people of God start thinking like that, when anybody starts thinking like that, God has a tendency to take them out into the wilderness. Because in the wilderness, only God can provide for you there. Nobody makes the mistake of thinking, man, I'm really making it out here. God has to intervene, and often supernaturally, to do so. Which brings us to this passage. Because that's what it says, right? Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak, and I love this line, tenderly to her. We probably should bring some application there. Those people have hurt us so greatly. Maybe they're still hurting us. What kind of impact could a tender word of response be? How do you turn a disobedient, sinful, rebellious nation back to you if you're God? Well, you have a couple of options. You can punish them. But honestly, as I think the Bible teaches, shows in many places, punishment just never really seemed to work. Or you can speak tenderly to them. That will work with some of them, the ones God has chosen. In other words, how did God get us to turn back to Him? By pouring out His wrath on us, or by sending His Son to die on a cross for us? It's pretty clear that God's mode of turning His enemy into His friend is to surprise him with unexpected love and tenderness and compassion. Try it sometime. It doesn't always work. It didn't always work with God. But I think the implication is it's the only thing that will work, at least with some. And if we really want a restoration with that family member, or a restoration with our coworker, or a restoration with that person in school that, you know, just made our lives a nightmare, if we really want a restoration, are you ready to speak tenderly? God spoke tenderly to Israel. And there I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. Let me give you a couple of illustrations, both of the making, just an incredible fertility of the land, but why he brings her into the wilderness. Every married couple probably has a similar experience. They may not, but they likely would have a similar experience. One of my daughter's favorite movies is The Parent Trap. Right? Here's a couple who their marriage is broken. And these two daughters are scheming to try to get it back together. What's the first thing they do in their scheme to get their mom and dad back together? Think about it. What's the first thing that they do? They try to recreate the place and time that they met. That's what they do in the movie. Can I suggest that's what God's doing? It would be like if Mary and I were having problems, I'd be a smart man to take her back to Estes Park, because that's where we met. That's where we fell in love. That's where some of the best memories of our relationship were. It's in that environment. And that's why Mary loves Estes Park. She loves going there. She loves going to the little chapel that we got married in. And I'm a guy. I could care less. If I'm going to go to Estes Park, let's go hike up Mount, Long's Peak. Let's go to Wild Basin. Go to the little chapel in Little Valley. Why? But that's where she wants to go. This is what God's doing, isn't it? He lures her out into the wilderness where they met, where they got married, where He said, I will be your God and you will be my people. He lures her there because He knows maybe she'll remember. Maybe she'll remember that day that she came down the aisle, literally, right? Walked down the aisle of the Red Sea. Walls of water on both sides. Maybe she'll remember as she came out and I delivered her from all of those things that she dreaded. All of her fears washed away in one big wave over Pharaoh's army. Maybe she'll remember the reception where Miriam danced and Israel partied all night long. That's where He took her. God says, I'm going to lure her out into the wilderness and I'm going to speak tenderly to her there. I think the passage, that's what it's implying. The reason why He's taking her out there, this is where they first met. This is where they first met. And when I get her out there, I'm going to show her. I'm going to show her in a way that she will never be able to forget again. Because it's not just, I'm not just going to give her manna, little tiny pieces of bread that show up on the ground. I'm going to turn that wilderness into the Garden of Eden. I'm going to turn into the Garden of Eden. And then she will know, it's always been me. It's always been me that's been taking care of her. It's always been me that has been providing for her. It was never those gods. It was never their hard work. It was never their intellect. It was never their creativity. It was never because they were a little bit better at something than somebody else. It was always me. I will take care of them, and they'll never be able to deny it. It would be kind of like when I lived in American Falls, there is a valley outside of American Falls called Pleasant Valley. Pleasant Valley is one of the richest pieces of farmland in the country. When I first got there, it was only a couple years old at that point. They would tell stories about a few years back, they were getting $18 a 100-pound sack of potatoes. $18! Now, that's a lot for you who don't know the price of potatoes. That's a lot of money. And there was a farmer out in Pleasant Valley that had 1 million 100-pound sacks. He was greedy. He thought it was going to go up. And all of a sudden, the farmers in Washington started sending their potatoes to Lamb Weston, and the price went down to $12. And that man lost $6 million in one day. But that's how rich that land is. These farmers don't understand farmers in Michigan or in the Midwest. They don't understand the struggle. These farmers, they are on just a cash cow. Can you imagine if they thought, well, that's because we're better than the farmers in Michigan. We know how to do it better than they do. They just haven't learned our techniques. We know when to put the fertilizer on. We work harder than they do. You know, we're willing to get up early in the morning and work all the way into night. We put lights on our tractors. They actually do. And during harvest, they work 20 hours a day. See, we're just willing to work. That's why we are more prosperous and more wealthy. Nonsense. The reason why they're more prosperous and more wealthy is because several years ago, that land was worthless. And then they figured out that there was a river that ran underground somewhere up by Chalice. The water dived underground and ran right underneath Pleasant Valley. And guess what they did? They tapped into it. Now, did they provide that river? No. God provides it. And he turned absolutely worthless land into a rich, rich land. I guarantee you, there are farmers in Pleasant Valley today that are taking credit for what God has provided for them. They're taking credit for it, just like Israel did. And it would be like if God came along and said, I've had it with that. I'm going to dry up the river. I'm going to dry everything up, and we'll see how well you can grow crops. And everything would die within a year. That's the thing about that valley. If it didn't have water, they wouldn't even be able to have a crop next year. And it's dead. And this is what God did for Israel. I'm going to take away all of that blessing. That was in verse 6 and 7 of chapter 2. I'm going to take away all of the fertility of the land. Why? So that you will stop worshiping Baal. Since you think Baal's the one doing it for you, I'll take it away until you have nothing to praise Baal for. Until you realize Baal can't do anything. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to lure you out into the wilderness, and I'm going to turn the wilderness into the Garden of Eden. Now, I know my brother can appreciate this illustration because we have been lost in the wilderness. It's the only place we've ever been lost, I think. But right next to Pleasant Valley is this thing called a lava desert. It goes for like 100 square miles. And in fact, you can be in some of the richest farmland, and within 5 minutes, you're walking into this lava desert. Let me tell you, if God took the farmers of Pleasant Valley and lured them out into the lava desert, and he turned that into a lush Garden of Eden, there is no one in the world that would not say, that be God, that's not us. If you've ever seen that place, and you do, if you're driving down I-15, you're getting near Blackfoot, there's a nice little rest area on both sides, the lava desert fringes on the highway. Look at that ground. Go walk out on top of it, and I'd like to see you plant even a blade of grass out there and get it to grow, let alone vineyards. This is what God's saying. I'll lure her out into the wilderness, and I will turn the wilderness into the Garden of Eden for her. A day will come in the latter days, at the end of the age, where I'll make a new covenant with my people. And that covenant will include a covenant with the beasts of the field. It will be just like it was in the days of the Garden of Eden. I will restore my creation, and I will restore my people, and I will restore the land of Israel. And I will do it in such a way that no one will be able to deny that it is Yahweh, our God, who is providing for us. Sometimes, guys, God takes us out into the wilderness and strips everything away from us so that he can provide for us in such a way that we cannot deny, oh, this is God. This is God doing this for us. This is God who's building us up. Interestingly, God really isn't even talking that much about agriculture here. He's talking about people. He's going to sow people in the land of Israel. And as Isaiah says in 48:48, wow, where did all these people come from? Where did all these potatoes come from? It's because God has done this great work in bringing people into his land and restoring them. People that did not know him, people who never knew him, people who were not his people but now are his people, people who are not his loved ones but are now his loved ones. They're going to be everywhere because God, in his gracious love and kindness, reaches out not only to Israel but to the nations of the world, and he draws them to a place called Calvary, where his son, as we celebrated, hung and died, that they may have life and have it more abundantly. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for Hosea and how it reminds us of the gospel. It's hard to read Hosea without thinking about Jesus and your love for us while we were still enemies. Lord, I pray that this message will penetrate our heart, turn us towards you, create the response that you are seeking, the response that you actually mentioned in the passage, that we will just give in and say, I do. I will take you to be my loving husband, as Israel will do in the last days. May we not wait. May we, this morning, receive you into our lives, embrace you as our God, our Father, even our loving husband, as the image calls us to do. I pray this in your Son's precious name. Amen.